Get complete cross media and full funnel ad measurement with Disco. Only Disco measures all media channels, including social platforms. Also, you can connect what people think with what they actually do online after ad exposure. And did we mention that Disco's ad measurement is not reliant on cookies? Leading brands, agencies, and media companies choose Disco to measure brand lift and performance outcomes. Learn why at DISQO.com.
Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the impact of partition on Ireland, the story of the stealth fighter and stealth bomber and the competing companies who built them, how Dublin doubled in size and moved to the sea in the 18th century. And then to end the show, we'll explore the genius of Vincent van Gogh. In recent weeks, we've had some brilliant shows on Thomas Kent, Thomas Hardy, and lots of great new books. And if you want to listen back to any of these, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show with the impact of partition. Brexit has ensured that the subject of the border continues to be a live one in Irish politics. And an excellent new book by Cormac Moore explores how the border was born. It investigates how the 1921 partition of Ireland had huge ramifications for almost all aspects of Irish life and was directly responsible for hundreds of deaths and injuries, with thousands displaced from their homes and many more forced from their jobs. The book is called Birth of the Border: The Impact of Partition in Ireland. It's published in paperback by Merriam and costs €22.95. The author is Cormac Moore. And Cormac, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
You begin in your introduction by talking about the uncertainty and confusion of partition. And that really is the story of the birth of the border, isn't it? The fact that it came about without people necessarily always wanting it or planning for it.
Yeah, actually, Michael Laffin describes it very well in saying, if you were to put yourself back in 1911 and you were to try and guess what was going to happen in the following 10 years, there was no way you would have come to the solution that actually did come about in 10 years later. So much happened in that intervening period. It mattered a lot. And there were so many twists and turns. There was so much uncertainty. There were so many avenues that the course could have taken. So that is the story of partition, really.
And something that began as a kind of a wrecking device and it was intended to be perhaps a temporary exclusion of Ulster developed into the establishment of a completely separate jurisdiction with its own parliament.
Well, even unionists would have found it quite ironic that they never wanted home rule, and they actually ended up with a home rule jurisdiction before the rest of Ireland did. So, it certainly, that was definitely not envisaged when the quite strong, vociferous anti-Home Rule campaign started with the introduction of the Third Home Rule Bill in 1912. It certainly took a different avenue. And when the Government of Ireland Bill was introduced in 1919, it shocked a lot of people that actually Ulster, or part of Ulster, was going to get its own Home Rule Parliament.
It's a fascinating story because you have a Conservative Party willing to break the law. You have a British government making different promises and sometimes contradicting itself. And it's a story that you see history at all. It's at its most messy.
Yeah, well obviously it's being repeated right now. If you look at Andrew Bonar Law, a very interesting character, he was the leader of the Conservative Party, and he was an extremely rabid unionist, anti-Sinn Féiner, and he did in 1912 and 1913, he did threaten that, if Ulster was forced into a Home Rule Parliament, there was no length to which he wouldn't go to stop it. So, there's definitely a very veiled threat there of using the going if needed to stop Ulster from being forced into Home Rule. And there's loads of examples of even Bonar Law again, when James Craig asked for his own special constabulary, actually this month in 1920, Bonar Law said, well, this mightn't look too partial, but ultimately they did decide to actually give Ulster its own special constabulary. And that was even before the Government of Ireland Bill became an act in December of that year. So there are loads of examples of British government working in bad faith, not actually being impartial, and ultimately siding with Ulster Unionists almost at every turn.
The book also shows how difficult it was to create a new jurisdiction, that they had to create it virtually from scratch and work out how you were going to run the judicial system, how you would deal with things like education, and that they were starting off with virtually nothing and having to create this new unit.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about the way Ireland was governed before two jurisdictions came on the island, under the Acts of Union of 1800, even though Ireland in many ways became closer to the UK, in other ways it didn't, in that it was always treated as a single entity, and you know, it had its own Lord Lieutenants, Chief Secretaries, it had its own administration, whether it be Dublin Castle or even non-public bodies, were all administered from Dublin, and Ireland was treated as a single unit, pretty much run from Dublin. So when you decide to, break that up and actually create a whole new jurisdiction, now the Irish Free State actually borrowed and received a lot of the government and structures from old, but in Belfast there were no structures. So you had a very important figure who not many people know about, Sir Ernest Clarke. He became the Under Secretary for Ulster. Before the Government of Ireland Act came into being. And he was the person mainly responsible for creating the jurisdiction from scratch, creating seven government departments, getting their furniture even, recruiting all the staff for those different departments. And he said himself, "I arrived in Belfast armed only with a table, a chair, and an Act of Parliament." And he was working pretty much, 15, 16-hour days for 7 days a week, from September 1920 up until May 1921, when Northern Ireland came into being.
And people mightn't be aware of just how much violence accompanied the birth of Northern Ireland. Large numbers killed and people forced out of their homes burnt. Really quite shocking examples of violence.
Yeah, no, you could probably strongly argue that more civilians died in Belfast than any other part of Ireland during the whole War of Independence era. In fact, most of the casualties were innocent civilians. And it all started pretty much in after the 12th of July celebrations in 1920, when Catholics and Protestant socialists, or rotten prods as they were called, were essentially turfed out of the shipyards and of other places of employment. And so you had waves of violence from July 1920 up until July 1922, where, in about 550, the figures are changing, as we get to know more about how many casualties there were. But approximately there's 550 killed in the kind of violently in that six-county period, most of them in Belfast, around 460, 470 killed in Belfast in that two-year period. And as I said, most of them were killed for, were innocent civilians. In most cases, they were killed because of their religion, nothing else.
Your book also shows that the Irish revolutionaries and then the leaders of the new Irish state made mistakes when it came to dealing with partition and with the new state. They showed a certain naivety, for example, in their belief that the Boundary Commission would solve everything, and they made mistakes when the new Irish state was created in terms of how they dealt with this new entity.
I would think Sinn Féin made mistakes pretty much from the time they became the largest national party in Ireland after the 1918 general election. They had no real policy on the north. They had no coherent strategy on how to deal with unionists and to deal with that problem. And they never even really tried to attempt to solve it. As you said, they naively believed that once Britain left, the unionists would happily come into United Ireland, which was never on the cards. And so they made a number of disastrous decisions. The first one they made was they had a Belfast boycott. I can understand why they wanted to do something with the exclusion of Catholics from a place of employment in Belfast. But to have a boycott in Belfast when most industries in the north had international markets, and the biggest industries in the north were shipbuilding and linen and agriculture, that their customers were not based in the south. And they also believed that this would help Northern Ireland realise they needed the south, which was unrealistic. So that was a very bad policy. number one. Then during the treaty negotiations, I believe Sinn Féin blundered greatly in accepting that boundary commission without getting, you know, rigid terms agreed. They should have had a plebiscite agreed to. They should have, had everything written down in stone and have no ambiguity, particularly with Clause 12, which dealt with the boundary commission and with in the treaty. And that ambiguity ultimately resulted in no changes to the border when the boundary commission finally did meet in 1924 and shelved this report in late 1925. Sinn Féin also, or an iteration of Sinn Féin, the first Cumann na Gael government, also imposed customs on the north in 1923. And that also, that and the boycott helped create a psychological partition and between north and south. In some cases, that had never existed before. So, overall, Sinn Féin and its iteration after the Irish Free State came into being had really bad policies on the north and actually helped make partition more permanent and in no way helped to resolve the issue.
And it's interesting how many organisations ignored the new border and continue to operate on an all-islands basis. And it included some religions, some sports organisations, even some trade unions and charities that for some it was as if this partition had never happened.
Yeah, and most of those organisations are still all-Ireland bodies. I've actually done quite a bit of research on other international partitions, international divisions. And Ireland is a very unique example where that the international boundary has been ignored by most non-political organisations to a large extent since its inception. So as you mentioned, most religions, if you look at pretty much all the religions except Judaism, it was administered and is administered on an all-Ireland basis, including all of the Protestant religions, where most of their members were based in the north. Also, sports. You look at the only sports really that divided were soccer and athletics. And as I have outlined in my last book, the Irish soccer split, it was more for internal reasons than for the actual partition of Ireland. And the reason was that first of all, there was no such clamouring for an entity called Northern Ireland. You know, most unionists never saw themselves as Northern Irish. That identity of being Northern Irish is a very recent phenomenon. In the 1920s, you know, you were either Irish, you either saw yourself as Irish, British, or from Ulster. And of course, the North was not just Ulster, it was only a part of Ulster, not all nine counties. So it was very hard to cling to this new identity, and unionists still saw themselves as Irish, but as British as well. And that's in many respects why they would have clung to Irish organisations within the empire. So if you look at rugby had a very strong connection to the other home nation. So even the soccer authorities believed Ireland should be one single entity within Britain. So, that's in many ways why organisations remained all-Ireland bodies after partition. And the governments, whether North or South or the British governments, they weren't enforcing honour bodies to divide on the political lines either.
And finally, Cormac, what do you see as the impact of partition?
Overall, I do think it was a messy solution. I think, if you look at it morally, it doesn't stand under scrutiny. Yeah, of course, it's very difficult to accommodate genuine Ulster Unionist concerns. But I do think partition was messy. If you look at particularly in Tyrone, Fermanagh, the way it was constructed definitely did not take into account the nationalist majorities of Tyrone and Fermanagh. And also, partition in many ways was always brought in, at least publicly, to make sure that minorities were not mistreated by the overall majority. And what you had instead was that you had particularly Northern jurisdiction, whereby you had a minority totally undermined and mistreated by the majority. And even in the Irish Free State, the minority was mistreated as well. So you did not have a good solution. The partition of 1921 really did lead to the troubles of the late 1960s. And obviously it still is a very contested entity.
Okay, well, Cormac, thanks a million for joining us tonight. The book is called Birth of the Border: The Impact of Partition in Ireland. It's published in paperback by Merian and costs €22.95. The author is Cormac Moore. And Cormac, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book explores the race to discover an airplane that was invisible to radar and the development of the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber by two rival companies. The book is called Stealth: The Secret Contest to Invent Invisible Aircraft. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs about €20. And I'm delighted to welcome the author Peter Westwick to the show tonight. Peter, you're very welcome.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was the first thing that surprised me about this book. I had known about the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber, but I had always just assumed that they had been made by the same company and that there hadn't been this extraordinary rivalry between two companies to try and get there first.
Right. And they really, what struck me is they really took these two different approaches to this one. It's the same problem of how do you make an aircraft that is relatively or more or less invisible to aircraft. And they came up with these two very different solutions to the same problem, which was, to me, really the origins of the research.
And it's fascinating that because, as you showed, they look so different. And as you say, the approaches that the scientists took was so different. Could you maybe talk to us about that maybe a little bit? How the people working on these even had a different perspective on how you might go about finding this solution?
Right. So I guess to step back a step, you know, I really didn't start with any intention of writing a history of stealth aircraft. I was doing these oral histories for a broader project on the history of aerospace in Southern California. And in the process of that, I was interviewing some engineers who had worked on stealth. And I realized that these responses to my questions in the interviews were providing an answer to this very seemingly simple question about why do the planes look so different? Why do the F-117 and the B-2 look so different? The F-117 is really strikingly flat and angular and kind of awkward looking. It doesn't look like a graceful aircraft at all. It's more like flying origami. And the B-2 is, by contrast, very aerodynamic and sleek and kind of graceful looking. And I realized that these engineers I was interviewing were basically answering this question by describing the arguments that were occurring between radar physicists on the one hand and aerodynamicists on the other in the design of these planes. And it was basically the answer to the question, you know, why the two different approaches was in the relation between these two disciplines in the two firms. So that was kind of the starting point, this kind of initial realization that, hey, there are these two very different approaches to the problem of stealth, and that the answer reveals these tensions within the companies, which were then kind of so it's competition on a couple levels. It's competition between Lockheed, which designed the F-117, and Northrop, which designed the B-2, but also competition within the firms between these two disciplines. And basically, whichever discipline, whichever people were on top in each company determined the appearance of the plane, which I thought was pretty fascinating. I mean, and then the second thing I realized was that these arguments within the companies, here I was reading these stories about these shouting matches that were like echoing down the hallways of the firms. And, you know, our image of the aerospace engineer is this, you know, very logical and rational and dispassionate person. But here I was hearing these stories about these arguments and shouting matches and this, you know, these very strong-willed personalities. And I realized this didn't really suit the public image of the aerospace engineer. So I thought this was kind of, you know, stealth would provide kind of an interesting window on the world of these engineers and how they actually worked and, you know, the daily life within the firms.
And you show also how the location of the companies was important as well. They're only 20 miles apart from each other. This was based in California. And even that milieu was important in terms of how these things were being developed.
Right, and that's part of the story too. Is I really wanted to set it in the context of Southern California, which is where, you know, where I am based, but also our project is about aerospace in Southern California. And we're really trying to answer the question, you know, why Southern California? Why did the aerospace industry, you know, in the United States and really the global aerospace industry, why did it concentrate so heavily in this one area? And people will say, well, it's the weather, it's nice, you know, blue skies, it doesn't rain very much, you can fly year-round. But there's really more to it than that. And it goes back a century to things like open shop labor and the availability of venture capital and research universities like Caltech and USC and UCLA. But there's also kind of a more intangible factor of this kind of, you know, creative entrepreneurialism, risk-taking, innovation. People still talk about, you know, this kind of the culture, the creative culture of Southern California. And there's actually, you know, Disney is kind of the one of the personifications of this, representations of this, you know, this kind of interesting mix of technology and innovation. And in fact, one of the things the book looks at are some of these kind of interesting connections between Disney and the actual stealth aircraft, specifically in the form of one person who designed some of the rides at Disneyland and then went on to become one of the principal designers of both aircraft.
So talk to us about, when did they start work then on trying to develop the stealth technology? When did they succeed? And how long was it before the world discovered that there was a plane that was invisible to radar?
Right. Well, I mean, it's a long, one of the things about points about the book is it's a long history of, you know, going back to the debut of aircraft in warfare, in World War One, you know, attempts to make airplanes invisible. I mean, first invisible, literally invisible to the naked eye. But then with the development of radar in the 1930s and then in World War II, attempts to make, you know, to somehow solve the problem, make radar aircraft less visible to radar. So it went back several decades. But one of the questions for the book is, you know, why did stealth emerge when it did, which was this really remarkable period in the 1970s of just fertile innovation. And part of that is the strategic need, U.S. strategy at the time, both in Western Europe and in the targeting of the Soviet Union itself, really required an airplane to be able to defeat these very formidable Soviet radar anti-aircraft systems. So part of it was the strategic demand, but also part of it was there was, several things came together. It wasn't just a single technology that enabled stealth. It was a very sophisticated theory of radar physics going back to World War II, basically. But an understanding of how radar waves scatter off of objects like aircraft. And, you know, by the 1970s, you have basically 2 decades worth of, you know, really concerted effort to understand just the basic theory and fundamentals of radar physics. And then the other crucial technology, well, 2 other crucial technologies. One is materials to absorb radar waves, but the other one was computers. And of course, by the 1970s, computers are getting more powerful, they're getting smaller. And computers were crucial in 2 respects. One is to design the plane, that is to make these very, very difficult calculations from the theories of radar physics to understand how the radar waves are scattering off of these aircraft designs. But the other crucial role for computers was then to be able to fly the planes. You know, what we think of as fly-by-wire, and now we are familiar with the role of aircraft, of computers, you know, flying airplanes. But these initial stealth aircraft, because of the demands of the radar physics, were very unstable in flight. And the first one from Lockheed was unstable in all 3 axes, you know, pitch, roll, and yaw. So you had to have a computer which would react faster than the pilot to keep these things in the air, or else they just would crash and burn. So all of these things came together in the 1970s. The F-117 was deployed during the 1980s, but then, of course, one of the other main points of the book is that, you know, the B-2 comes online and the Cold War ends and kind of, you know, knocks the props out from the strategic rationale for these aircraft. So then there's kind of this search for new strategic missions for these planes.
It's been a number of decades since the technology was discovered and developed. So I'm wondering, are there other countries in the world that now have that technology, for example, Russia and China?
Right. Well, of course, as the usual case in a technology, you know, there's a technology debuts and then your adversary tries to copy it, come up with their own version of it, and then also tries to defeat it. And one of the other points about the book is that, which I found very interesting doing the research, was that it was not just a case of the engineers designing the airplanes and coming up with these incredible designs on blueprints. The other part of the equation, of course, is making those planes and then turning those blueprints into actual flying hardware. So the whole manufacturing side of this was a really interesting part of the story. And that's the part that's been very difficult, I think, for other countries to reproduce is it's not just designing the planes and understanding how the radar waves work, but then actually, you know, forming these incredible shapes to these really tight tolerances and using these exotic composite materials like in the B-2, but then be able to, machine these and shape them and form them on the shop floor. So the story of the shop floor and the kind of blue collar side of stealth turned out to be as important as the kind of white collar world of the design engineers. And again, that's a part of the aerospace industry that we don't usually think about. You usually think about the aerospace engineer as, the white collar engineer with a slide rule and, the short sleeve white shirt and horn rimmed glasses. But these shop floor workers on the manufacturing side, they were also crucial to realizing stealth. And that's the side that some of these other countries have struggled with. You can see, there's pictures of the F-117, pictures of the B-2, but then to turn around and actually make one is an entirely different proposition.
Okay, well, Peter, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's a fascinating story and told so well in your book. It's called Stealth, The Secret Contest to Invent Invisible Aircraft, published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs about €20. The author, Peter Westwick. Peter, thank you so much.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. In the 1,000 years of Dublin's history, no period of expansion comes anywhere near that of the period 1708 to 1844, when the city more than doubled in size. All of this activity was triggered and continued to be driven during the entire period by the actions of the port authorities known as the Ballast Board and, after 1786, the Corporation for the Preservation and Improvement of the Port of Dublin. And the story has been told in a brilliant new book. It's called Dublin Moving East, How the City Took Over the Sea. It's published in hardback by Wordwell and costs €35. And I'm delighted to welcome its author, Michael Branigan, to the show tonight. Michael, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
You've done incredible research going to archives all across the place to really bring together the story of a period of expansion that most of our listeners won't be aware of.
Yes, that's true. But really, I was following the breadcrumbs. It wasn't a plan. I had no idea where the story would lead. But I just followed the breadcrumbs and kept finding other places to go. And people were very kind. It could have been my age.
So talk to me about this expansion and begin in 1708. Was it a deliberate decision to grow the city and this expansion and the movies, or was it just as a result of increased trade and other factors?
No, it was post the Boyne, if you like, and the Williamite Wars. The authorities were now in total control in terms of military, finance, and politics. And so they were able to make the decision to do something about the harbour, because trade was falling off and there was no way to increase trade unless money was spent and improve the harbour facilities. So in other words, it was the merchants who drove and the financiers who drove the improvements.
And corn was a major product in this period and a very important factor in terms of that trade and in terms of revenue.
Yes, it was. Yeah, very much so. It comes up in relation to the buildings. Corn was enormously important, and the buildings show that. Trade was in corn. It was almost like a currency, and everything was based on trade. It was vital.
So let's talk about something like the Great North Bull Wall.
Yeah.
Your research uncovered how the wall was built, how it was paid for, and what exactly was going on with this important construction.
Well, yes, the harbour was still dangerous, and the events of I think it was 1807, the double tragedy where nearly 500 people were lost on the shores at Black Rock and Sea Point. So. The problem remained in Dublin Bay, and in fact, if you go out to sea to Sandymount today, you can look out on the empty tide on the shore, and you can see the ships are anchored miles out to sea. Well, that applied equally before the wall was built, and they needed to create a harbour. So the first attempt was to create a packet harbour at Hoth. And that didn't work. And eventually they got sense and attempted to build Dunleary. But in the meantime, the Port of Dublin needed protection. And the plans were formulating over a 20-year period to install a second wall in Dublin Bay. And that became the North Bull Wall. The whole trick became, where was it going to be? How was it going to be located? And so on and so forth. And they eventually settled on the present site, because John Rennie and Page and Bly had suggested walls over on the other side, almost parallel to the south wall. But that was never going to work, because the river then would have been too powerful, and it would have scrubbed out all the basic stones, and the ships would have wound up lying on their keels. So that wouldn't have worked. So they built the second wall, and it was completed in 4 years. There was very little information. People just say it was built, but no detail was ever discovered. And I happened to discover two volumes in the National Archives, which even the guys in the National Archives didn't appear to be aware of their existence, but they were stored in the basement of the forecourts. And they gave chapter and verse on all the details of actually how the wall was constructed and why it was constructed, but most important, all the details. And it was there that I was able to ascertain that the dredging took place on the Bar of Dublin at the same time. So by the time they were finished in 1824, after just under 4 years, it wasn't even 4 years, when you consider that the other wall had taken 100 years, or closely to it, we finally had, if you like, a structure and a place of some sort of refuge. But it still wasn't the best, because it's quite narrow and it shelves, as we all know.
And it's extraordinary, even your subtitle, How the City Took Over the Sea. That's such an important part of the story, constructions like that, because without that conquering of the sea, this expansion and this turning of Dublin into one of the great European cities would never have been possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. There's no question about that. When you unfold, particularly on the north side, and I do say particularly because there were structures on the south side, but when you see 80 years after the south wall was built, even before the north bull wall was built, when you see and identify the number of enormous structures that were created on the north side, like Annesley Bridge, which then changed all the topography on the north side, the construction of O'Connell Street, or Sackville Street, it was called, the Custom House, and the Carlisle Bridge, and the forecourts, all of those took place in the last 20 years of the 18th century. But even more important, when you think that at one stage there were, I think it's 9 or 10 bridges were under construction within a mile and a half of one another. That, for me, was the extraordinary turning point, as, if you like, as a provoker of interest in the material.
And how would you describe then the people involved on the ballast board, and then the Corporation for the Preservation and Improvement of the Port of Dublin? Would you describe them as visionaries? Were they pragmatists? Were they idealists? What's your sense of what they were working towards?
Well, I suppose that they were a mix of all people. I mean, they were the elite. They were the power, if you like, in the city, but they had an overriding vision that the growth of the city depended on their application of improvement all the time. And I mean, that stemmed from the original division of the north and south lots. I mean, when you look back on the map of Bolton of 1717, where it shows the north lots extending way out past the Talca banks, out into Clontarf, it shows that these people were truly visionaries, about the best way to describe it. You know, way ahead in their thinking. And that they weren't intimidated by the vastness of the project.
Very good. Well, Michael, thank you so much for bringing us this story. It's called Dublin Moving East, How the City Took Over the Sea. It's published in hardback by Wordwell and costs €35. The author, Michael Branigan. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Patrick. Yes.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Talking History on News Talk. Well, welcome back to Talking History. Vincent van Gogh's letters have long been prized as some of the most valuable documents in the world of art. Not only do they throw light on van Gogh's own complex and intriguing character, they enlighten the whole creative process as seen through his eyes. And a new book, Vincent van Gogh, A Life in Letters, brings together the letters of one of the world's greatest creative minds. It's called Vincent van Gogh, A Life in Letters, published in hardback by Thames and Hudson. It costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The editors are Ninka Bakker, Leo Janssen, Hans Luton, and I'm delighted to welcome one of the editors, Ninka Bakker, to the show tonight. Ninka, you're very welcome.
Hello, thank you. For inviting me.
Oh, it's absolutely our pleasure. Can I begin by asking how important are these letters to, I suppose, understanding so many things, art history, scholarship, and even the whole process of creativity?
Well, Van Gogh's letters are a very important source for our knowledge about his work. They are a kind of first-hand account of the creation of his paintings and drawings. And of course, they contain a lot of beautiful sketches showing what he's working on. So his art and his letters are really inextricably linked. In his letters, we can follow his development as an artist. He writes about his working methods, his ideas about art, his sources of inspirations, what he wants to express in his work. So they are extremely important as an art historical source, but of course they're also really a joy to read because for the way they are written, they're so lively and personal and sincere. I mean, reading them, you really come very close to the artist and the man that was Van Gogh.
And of course, people are fascinated by his personality and just how tortured and how complex the personality was. Do we get a sense of that from the letters?
Oh yes, absolutely. He was indeed a complex personality with a lot of ideas, very personal ideas. If you really want to get to know him, I can only say read these letters and reread them, really, because there's so much in it, and you really get a really good sense of his personality. He was very enthusiastic. He was very persistent, very passionate, but he also was very stubborn and very difficult to be around. And but on the other hand, he was always very full of ideas, of plans, of dreams. Very outspoken, really in all matters, but especially in artistic matters. So the letters are really the best way to bring you very close to him, to his thoughts and feelings.
And he was a very good letter writer. Did that come as a surprise to you?
Well, I've been reading these letters for a lot of years now. So I think, yes, they immediately struck me for the way they are written. They're very personal. They're very vivid, very direct, beautifully written. He knows very well how to express himself, how to get his arguments across too. He could be very, very convincing, and always wanted to convince. He could write very expressively, and he has this very strong ability to really evoke a scene or a landscape. He really had a talent for writing. It's a joy to read them, to reread them, and to be studying them. You always find new things in them.
And we get a sense of his views on friendship and on questions of life and death, and even in the personal kinds of relationships he have. Who was he mainly writing to?
Well, most of the letters, over 800 letters by Van Gogh are preserved. Most of them are written to his brother Theo, who was really his best friend, his supporter, his confidant. He wrote over 650 letters to him, or even more, but 650 have been preserved. So that's really the core of the correspondence. And another important part of the correspondence is formed by the letters to his youngest sister, Willemien, and also to those that he wrote to artist friends. And among them, Émile Bernard, who was a French artist, and Paul Gauguin, the famous French artist, they are the most important. And they really, these letters really show another side of Van Gogh. They are written in another tone. Also the ones to his sister, Willemien. So they really give another side of Van Gogh, and that's really interesting about these letters.
Do we learn anything about the artistic process and how he approached creating his great masterpieces?
Oh, yes, absolutely. When when Van Gogh decided to become an artist, everything in the letters is about achieving his artistic goals. So he really, the letters really trace his progress. They reveal his sources of inspiration, his artistic ambitions, and of course the sketches of his own works. They show, you know, what he wanted to say with his works, how he is proceeding, how he is sometimes struggling. So the letters really, sometimes almost from day to day, give you an account of his artistic process. Yes.
And there's a great honesty as well, because he's, you see the passion he has for his work, but you also see his doubts and fears and insecurities.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. He's very honest in his letters. Of course, he is struggling, as we all know, to set out, to find his way as an artist. And you can really follow that through the letters. He's very open about his doubts, his fears, his dreams, his hopes. So you really see that he, in the beginning, he is really not confident about his abilities as an artist, but that gradually comes more and more. But even after having created his masterpieces, he still felt he need to improve, and he wasn't there yet. And even when he starts to get some recognition, he kind of feels uncomfortable with it. He was afraid he could not live up to the expectations. So you can see it in the letters. He's very honest about that. He's not as confident as you would perhaps expect when you look at his works.
He was very close to his brother Theo, and that comes across in the letters. Can you tell us about their relationship?
Well, they were indeed very, very close. They started corresponding from an early age, because they were both working in different places, and so they were writing a lot to each other. And especially after Vincent's decision to become an artist, which was also something that Theo had advised him, he saw his being an artist as a kind of joint enterprise, and he involved Theo in also all of his plans. And Theo was kind of a sounding board for everything concerning his art work, but also he was his confidant in family issues, and the other way around, of course, because Theo also depended heavily on Vincent. And Theo, of course, provided financial and moral support to Vincent throughout the 10 years of his career as an artist. And this was a kind of deal they made. So Vincent sent him his artworks, and Theo sent him money so that Vincent could live and work. And this also intensified the correspondence, because from now on, Vincent had to, you know, confirm receipt of the money and keep Theo informed of his progress. So this was a kind of very intensive written contact, which was also very valuable, because they constantly exchanged his ideas about art, about life, about, you know, everything that that was on their mind.
And these are the surviving letters. Do we know that there were others that were destroyed?
Yes, there must have been many more, actually. In total, there are now over 900 letters that we still have. That's really thanks to Theo, who kept all the letters. So it's mostly letters written by Vincent to Theo, also to others. But there's a lot less received by Vincent, because Vincent was more careless about his mail. He was not keeping all his letters like Theo did. We know that he has thrown away or burnt letters that he received. But some of the letters that he received, they have survived because he sent them on to Theo to read, to let him read them. So it's really thanks to Theo, and then also thanks to his wife, Jo van Gogh Bonger, and their son, who created the museum. So that's how they ended up in the museum. And most of them, over 90% of the letters, are now actually in the Van Gogh Museum.
And we were hoping that you might perhaps read one of the letters for our listeners.
Oh, yes. Well, I've selected a very beautiful letter from Vincent to Theo from July 1888. when Vincent is in Arles, and he's really enthusiastic about Provence, and he loves the countryside, and he writes about the beautiful nature there to Theo. And this letter is also very beautiful because he's sharing his thoughts about life and death, and that's quite philosophical. So I'll write an excerpt of it, the 9 or 10 July 1888. My dear Theo, I've just come back from a day at Montmajour, and my friend, the second lieutenant, kept me company. So the two of us explored the old garden, and we stole some excellent figs there. If it had been bigger, it would have made you think of Zola's Paradoux. Tall reeds, grapevines, ivy, fig trees, olive trees, pomegranate trees with fat flowers of the brightest orange, 100-year-old cypresses, ash trees and willows, rock oaks. Half-demolished staircases, ruined Gothic windows, clumps of white rock covered in lichen and pieces of collapsed wall scattered here and there in the undergrowth. I brought back another large drawing of it. Not of the garden, though. That makes 3 drawings. When I have half a dozen, I will send them. I think the heat is still doing me good, in spite of the mosquitoes and flies. The cicadas, not those at home, but like this, and then he makes a little sketch in his letter of a cicada, you see them in Japanese albums, and golden and green cantharide swarming on the olive trees. These cicadas, they sing at least as loudly as a frog. It's certainly a strange phenomenon that all artists, poets, musicians, painters are unfortunate in the material sense, even the happy ones. What you were saying recently about Guy de Maupassant proves it once again. That rakes up the eternal question, is life visible to us in its entirety? Or, before we die, do we know of only one hemisphere? Painters, to speak only of them, being dead and buried, speak to a following generation or to several following generations through their works. Is that all, or is there more, even? In the life of a painter, death may perhaps not be the most difficult thing. For myself, I declare I don't know anything about it. But the sight of the stars always makes me dream, in as simple a way as the black spots on the map representing towns and villages make me dream. Why, I say to myself, should the spots of light in the firmament be less accessible to us than the black spots on the map of France? Just as we take the train to go to Tarascon or Rouen, we take death to go to a star. What is certainly true in this argument is that while alive, we cannot go to a star, any more than once dead, we'd be able to take the train. So it seems to me not impossible that cholera, the stone, consumption, cancer are celestial means of locomotion, just as steamboats, omnibuses, and the railway are terrestrial ones. To die peacefully of old age would be to go there on foot. For the moment, I'm going to go to bed because it's late, and I wish you good night and good luck. Handshake. Ever yours, Vincent.
Brilliant and beautifully read there, Ninka. Thank you so much. A final question then. Where would you place Van Gogh in the pantheon then of great artists and great creative minds?
Well, I think it's safe to say that Vincent van Gogh was one of the greatest painters in Western art. He has had a great influence on many artists that came after him, and that's still up to today. So, he's very original and, he has created a body of works in a very short amount of time that is still very influential and very beautiful and that really get emotional when they look at his paintings. And I think they're very personal, but he's expressing feelings that we can all relate to. And I think that makes them so powerful, his paintings and drawings.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight to share this with you. The book is called Vincent van Gogh, A Life in Letters. It's published in hardback by Thames and Hudson and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The editors are Ninka Backer, Leo Janssen, Hans Luton, and delighted to be joined there by Ninka Backer, and who read beautifully from one of those letters. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we have a special treat treat for you. We are going to be bringing you a show on the musical genius Beethoven on this, the 250th anniversary of his birth. It's a show we had to postpone because of the pandemic. We are not letting anything get in our way now, and we are going to bring you some music, some politics, and an awful lot of brilliant chat. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.